you'll never do. The rules and such never bothered you. You call the shots and they follow. I watch you steal from a distance and go back to my room. You'll never know.
And indeed, over the years, the talk of Los Angeles, in terms of the talk of the town, has got to be the Los Angeles Master Chorale. And when you add to that the fact that the newly appointed president and chief executive officer of the Los Angeles Master Chorale since 2015 is online at present, we say we are honestly delighted, beyond reason, to welcome Gene Davidson to the production. Gene, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. Thank you for having me on.
A genuine delight. And what can I say? I mean, chief executive of the New York Live Arts, executive director and chief executive officer. You ensured that New York Live Arts fulfilled its mission, and you've gone from East Coast to West Coast.
I have.
Yep, that makes perfect sense. I'll introduce you to five wonderful co-presenters who are with us. We have Claire Margerison, Emily Jones, Fiona Williams, Tessa Snart, and Mary Dancy in the studio, all keen to kind of just generally explore the wonders of the Los Angeles Master Chorale, of course, at Walt Disney Concert Hall. And as we sort of regularly say, I mean, one of the things about this from the perspective of music, first and foremost, is the quality of the productions that work through. And we know Grant Gershon is a wonderful artistic director and an ace scenario. But just when I think you can't go any further, you kind of host a whole range of new activities for the 2016-17 season.
That's right. And I have to say, one of the things that attracted me to move across the country to the West Coast was the incredible artistry of our singers. They're just incredibly virtuosic. The artistry is at a really high level. And the first time I saw them perform, I was blown away. I talk about having one of these perfect moments where the world kind of stops around you and you're inside of this very magical moment. And I had that experience, and it's quite wonderful. And yes, we're doing a range of works. Historically, the organization has, but we're focused now on commissioning even more works for the Forum. So next year's season, we'll have a mix of some of the most favorite choral works, Beethoven's Musa Solemnis, for example, and then we'll be commissioning a series of new works from the likes of Eric Whitaker, Moira Smiley, Billy Childs. It's going to be a very fun season.
Let's open it up a wee bit. Let's go to Mary. Any thoughts from your good self in terms of Gene's work and the Los Angeles Master Chorale per se?
Yes, your job sounds fantastic. I'd love
a bit close to the microphone, otherwise we'll be way off base.
Can you hear me okay?
Literally, physically.
Yes, now I can hear you better. Thanks.
Go. I was just thinking that your job sounds fantastic. So, so cultural as well. Like, can you maybe like run us through how we kind of got there, I suppose?
Oh my gosh, that's a very long story, and I'll spare you all the details. But yeah, I've worked in the arts my entire career. I went to a college in Ohio called Oberlin College that is has a very strong arts program, and so I was very fortunate to have that experience. And throughout my career, I've worked really between regional theater. I started in theater, classical music. I worked with the cellist Yo-Yo Ma for many years and was one of the first folks to help him start the Silk Road Project. And then I went over into the dance world and worked with the brilliant choreographer Bill T. Jones and his Bill T. Jones Arnazine Dance Company. And that actually led to an opportunity to, we had a merger of two nonprofit organizations in New York where we ended up in a beautiful 20,000 square foot facility with a theater and rehearsal studios, and that organization is now called New York Live Arts, which is where I was right before this.
And just looking at some of the figures, though, I mean, we worked with Yo-Yo Ma, obviously, you developed the Smithsonian Folklife Festival. 4.5 million visitors and over 400 artists from 26 countries. I know we're not necessarily into number crunching, but by anybody's rating, Gene, that's some phenomenal numbers from that point of view. You know, proving that, again, we have an innate desire and an essential sort of need for artistic material to kind of, you know, explore that aspect of the human condition.
I think that's right, and that particular folklife festival was called the Silk Road. Now I'm going to butcher the name of it because it was so long, it was 2002, but it was about connecting cultures and creating trust. And the Silk Road regions, as you likely know, go from Japan all the way through Asia, up through Turkey and into Italy, and it was very shortly after September 11th that we held that festival. And so I think there was a lot of interest from Americans in learning more about the cultures that were in the headlines, but from a positive experience. And we really believe that when you got to really know other cultures, you would have greater understanding for them.
And let's face it, Lord knows at present there are some candidates for the American presidency who could actually do with knowing a bit more about other cultures. But I won't go political on this one, Jean, because, you know.
And I agree.
Yeah, it's just we'll steer away from that. So we're going to take a short musical break now, because I want to actually go on to talk a little bit more about some of the exciting things that are upcoming. We're going to give you a choice. I mean, we've got some classic tunes from the Los Angeles Master Chorale ready. And Fiona, even though you're in Missouri, you weren't aware of the Los Angeles Master Chorale, were you?
No, sorry. No.
Well, it's okay. Well, the general choice that we're actually going to provide is my own personal favourite, which is Hold On, and that's always a classic. We could go for Danny Boy, which is another sort of classic routine, or we can go for Veni Creator Spiritus. Any particular thoughts there, Gene, in terms of what we should actually introduce folk with? I mean, Hold On, Danny Boy, or Veni Creator Spiritus? You know, we're obviously looking ahead to the Easter celebration from that point of view. Where do you suggest we should actually go, Gene Davidson?
Let's go with Hold On. I think that would be fun.
And then your wish is our command. Much deserving of a round of applause. Yay! See, even the recordings actually get a live round of applause. It's phenomenal, Gene. Generally, it's just wondrous on that particular basis. When you actually sort of first decided, well, first appointed, was it a case of almost a dream sort of post for yourself, Gene? Did you think, actually, yes, the Los Angeles Master Chorale, this is, you know, what I've been working towards? Or was it a case of, well, you know, it'll help with the Los Angeles scenarios?
Oh, my gosh, it's an amazing opportunity. I have to say, Grant Gershon is a very brilliant thinker and artist and just generally amazing human being. And so I feel very fortunate to have the opportunity to partner with him to further his artistic goals for the organization. And I was really drawn to the programming and was very excited by it. We just, on Sunday, performed it and presented the West Coast premiere of Julia Wolf's Pulitzer Prize-winning work, Anthracite Fields, with Bang on a Can All-Stars. It's a piece that touches on the mining industry in Pennsylvania and the Appalachian region and the labor conditions at the time and the development of protections for those workers. And it was a piece that was particularly close to me because I'm from that region in West Virginia. So doing work like that that is very socially relevant, but at the same time doing work that is just exquisite and of great beauty. So, for example, our next performance that is coming up April 16 and 17 is a rarely performed oratorio by Handel called Alexander's Feast, and that work is going to be staged by the opera director Trevor Ross. So it's the full range, and it's an amazing opportunity.
It just gets better and better. Tessa,
it does.
It's absolutely incredible. I just find it amazing how obviously you have this massive chorus and singers and how you actually organise the whole thing, get everybody together, because obviously everybody has their own part and musicians, and I just think it's incredible how it's all put together.
Is it a bit Gene, like, in a sense, you kind of as the ultimate owner of the number one baseball or indeed American football team? I'm using those routines as opposed to football, cricket. But when you look at that, you think, well, as long as Grant is with us, he can sort the thing through as artistic director. We'll just create a situation where it sort of happens, and then you sort of settle down and actually listen to just a tremendous example of the human voice at its best. Yeah.
I think that's right. It does take quite a bit of rehearsal time for 110 singers to learn their parts and go on stage and give a performance that is at 110%. We have an amazing group of artists working with us. The artistry doesn't get much better than this, I have to say. And I can't remember which one of you said that are you in Minnesota?
Well, that was it was originally Missouri, and that was Fiona.
Missouri.
Yeah.
Got it.
Well, easily confused.
I think that Los Angeles Master Chorale, one of my goals is, I think, not enough people know about them, and they're one of the jewels of the culture in this country, and so I've made it my personal mission to raise the visibility of the Master Chorale so that more people know of them and are able to experience the artistry, because it really is amazing.
I can't believe it's now the Los Angeles Master Chorale's 53rd season. I think we first started touching base with the fabulous organisation with Libby Hoebner, of course, and Laura, probably when you were in the 48th or 49th year. Those have just shot by from that perspective. But again, the quality is outstanding. Claire, thoughts from yourself?
Yeah, like everyone said, I think it sounds like you have an incredible job. But I was just wondering, do you have a typical day? And if so, what that is? Or is everything a little bit like as it comes?
Yeah, there's really no typical day, I have to be honest. I do a lot of meetings that are off the campus of the Music Center. We're one of the four resident companies of the Music Center in Los Angeles. We're here with the LA Philharmonic, the LA Opera, and Center Theater Group. And really no day looks like the day before and will not look like the day after, which I love. I'm a person who thrives on that.
Which makes you ideal for the post, of course. This is the sort of classic
line. I hope so.
Precisely. As we look ahead to some of the highlights of the LA Master Chorale's 53rd season, you mentioned, obviously, the Pulitzer Prize-winning piece that's come through. I'm particularly interested in the national and international guest conducting appearances, which we've actually got, because Grant is heading off to Cambodia, it would seem.
He is. He will be in Cambodia this summer in July in, I believe, Siem Reap. And then he will be conducting at the Wolf Trap Opera. And then next season he'll also have dates with the LA Opera. So he's a very busy conductor in addition to his work with us.
But as we frequently said, the big lacunae in the whole routine is we need more Los Angeles Master Chorale in Britain. This is the key thing. You know, when are you going to get over the Atlantic? This is to spread that word, Jean.
I agree. And you know what? We have a wonderful production that will open our season next year. And I hope I'm not going ahead of what you wanted to speak about. But Peter Sellers, the acclaimed stage director, is going to be staging a work called Lagrime di San Pietro, and that will open our season in October, and it will be the very first time he staged an a cappella work. It's for 21 singers, and it's very tourable, so we hope that presenters in Britain will come and see the work and consider bringing us to perform there.
And again, before that, of course, you've got three world premieres, 20th anniversary celebration of Morten Lauridsen's Lux Aeterna, with, again, you know, composer in residence, Morten Lauridsen, producing just wonderful quality. That's just outstanding. Emily, thoughts from yourself?
Well, I have to say I've not heard of the LA Master Chorale before today, which I think is a shame, because after hearing that, it was absolutely beautiful. So I really do think you should make your way over to the UK.
There we are. You see, it's unanimous, Jean.
I think it's a plan.
Yeah, exactly. We'll work our way through that process. And we'll have a word with our other Los Angeles correspondents to ensure that's sort of through. You mentioned some of the other highlights that's actually evolved with this side of things. When the curtain goes up, do you actually just say, right, I'm just going to go and sit back and soak up the atmosphere, or do you still fret from a point of view? Do you just think, oh, are they still going to like this? Or is it a case of, no, I know the team, it's going to be sensational?
Well, yeah, that's a really good question. And, you know, when you work your whole life in live performance, you've seen a lot. And I'm at a point now where I am able to sit in the house as an audience member. I'm usually with donors or board members and watch the performance and not worry so much about what's happening on stage. One of the beautiful things about live performance is anything can and will happen. And you grow accustomed to that. But it's a very well-rehearsed group, and I'm generally not concerned about there being any train wreck, but, you know, you never know what might happen in a live performance.
Somebody could inadvertently swallow a peanut before they're due to go on air. It could be a disaster. You know, all sorts of things could happen there.
All kinds of things. Yeah, fire alarm could go off. Any number of things.
And something which I've always been fascinated by, because we feature both the Los Angeles Master Chorale and the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra. Do you actually have any crossover with respect to that? Because next week, I know we're going to be joined by the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra's concert master, Margaret Batcher, who's talking about three evenings that they're having entitled Music and the Mind.
Yes, we have a wonderful relationship with the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, and we will be doing some work with them next season. And I'm afraid I don't have the dates right in front of me. But the organization has a long history of collaborating with LACO. They go by LACO.
Absolutely. I mean, LACO rhymes with Waco, but not with any sort of other sort of political undertones. I know we're actually going to be looking at some of the questions such as, how does a deaf musician compose? Are child prodigies born or made, or both? And is it possible to pinpoint the location of creativity in the brain? Which is something, again, which I think echoes the whole notion of this. Because, again, from a student point of view and the undergraduate perspective, I think it's been shown time and time again that if you are going to listen to music whilst you're doing your work or your essays, etc., classical music does actually stimulate more higher learning brain centres. There we are, you see. The pause says it all, really, from that sort of point of view. Jean, a reminder that if people are actually looking to find out more details about the Los Angeles Master Chorale course, the website remains www.lamc.org, and that'll take you to all sorts of wonderful things from that point of view. I feel as though we should get on a jet and fly over as soon as, from this point of view, or at least get a reverse situation structured. But it is your debut as far as the Midweek Drive is actually concerned, so I need to put to you those two critical questions that maybe Laura or Libby could have actually flagged up beforehand. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us from your own perspective? Has it been okay for you?
I'm sorry, can you say that again? Have I had a what?
Has the phone link, has the interview been okay with your good self? Have we passed the audition as far as interviews concerned?
Oh, it's been wonderful. It's been wonderful. I'm thrilled that you're interested in what we're doing, and I'm grateful that you've taken the time to speak with me today. Thank you so much.
Well, then I take it then the next question, which is, can we look forward to connecting with you again in the very near future? That will be in the affirmative. Will you come back to us, Jean?
I would love to do that. Thank you very much.
A round of applause for Jean, the fabulous top person behind the Los Angeles Master Chorale. We haven't even had a chance to really speak about the dance scenario there. Jean Davidson sort of work with respect to the DeVos Institute of Arts Management. There's a whole heap of other things to go through. We're going out with Veni, Creator, Spiritus, and the Los Angeles Master Chorale. Thanks to Penny Evans, who found the chorale music so relaxing. Quite rightly so. The Buggles as well, equally relaxing with Astro Boy, watching the proles on parade. It could almost be a theme for watching the people pass by the Starburst offices in Manchester. Couldn't it? Ace sequential art editor, Ed Fortune.
Hello, it could be. It is a lovely piece of people spotting that part of the world, actually.
Exactly. So, welcome along, and you've done a little Star Wars interview, which will be seeing the light of print in the very near future. Would you like to share anything else, or would it be a case of no, buy Starburst magazine?
I'm afraid it's going to have to be the latter.
Nice, that's all right. We go with that. We appreciate that. Let's do quick introductions. Emma sends her best. She couldn't make it. She's been working so hard since she last connected with your good self 8 English days ago. But we do have Claire Margerison, Emily Jones, Fiona Williams, Mary Dancy, and Tessa Snart in the studio, and I've just been sharing with them, of course, the fact that tomorrow morning, actually, on this very show, we will be joined by the coordinator of SFS, that's Sci-Fi Scarborough, who's going to be, it's one wonderful thing after the other, as highly praised by Shane Rimmer and others, of course, last year. Steve Dickinson, the founder of Sci-Fi Scarborough, is joining us. And it gets even better, because not only are you going to be there, Ed Fortune, but also guest on the show next week, Star Trek guru Larry Nemechek will be there as well.
Excellent.
Oh, just outstanding. However, that's what we found, really, and we thought, let's just move our way through that whole press. Other folk who'll be attending, of course, from the celebrity scenario, Josephine Gillen, who, of course, was at the Doncaster Digicon from Game of Thrones, Miltos Yerolamu, or even Yerolamu. Or what others? Also from Game of Thrones, Luke Barnes from Game of Thrones, Norman Lovett from Red Dwarf, John Campling from Harry Potter, Simon Fisher-Becker from Doctor Who and Harry Potter, Richard Hatch from Battlestar Galactica, and Garrett Wang, of course, from Star Trek Voyager, and Claudia Christian, also from Babylon 5. You were there last year. We weren't. What can the folk who actually go to Sci-Fi Scarborough expect to experience on the weekend on 9th and 10th of April 2016?
Fully integrated. community sci-fi event. So what is unique about Sci-Fi Scarves is Scarborough has been doing tourist entertainment for generations. And what's marvellous is you go there and this is a wonderfully built facility. There's an arena, the local bands. Pick up on the science fiction theme, so that local punk band for one day only will be, you know, Chewbacca and the Wookiees, and they'll be appropriately dressed and so on. And they really embrace it. So you get this whole massive community vibe going on, and yet you get all the things that you would get at a major Comic-Con style event. So you get all the various celebrities, you get all the various bits and pieces, you get all the various panels and talks and signings. There's an awful lot to see and to do. There's a lot, and every little thing, I think, community has been stitched together. So when we were there, there was a room all the way up the stairs that was filled with Minecraft computers. You think, well, why is that good? Well, it means that Dad can drop off, or Mum can drop off the kids at the Minecraft server so they can geek out all of Minecraft, and then they can go off and see Darth Vader, for example. So you get this kind of really integrated and really kind of busy event. And it's a lot of fun. It's also a really nice venue.
I think you sold it to us even without Steve Dickinson. So obviously take an additional commission on that side of things. We will, of course, be having a heck of a weekend because, like two audio postcards, we've also got Countryside Links at the Lincolnshire Showground, which is on the Sunday the 10th of April. So lots of exciting things there. So, Emily, Sci-Fi Scarborough is a case of, if only I was here, I'd be there, but I'll be back in Gloucester.
Gloucester?
Well, Shrewsbury. Shropshire. You know, it's in the region of Gloucester.
Yeah, well, I think I've been to a couple of Comic-Cons now and every single one is different and they've always got a bit of a different theme. I'm probably going to make my way around most of them, to be honest, eventually. Sure, so I'll make it to Scarborough eventually.
And Tessa? You've never experienced a science fiction Comic-Con, have you?
No, I haven't. No. So maybe
this would be the moment, exactly.
Yeah, I broadly split them into three very rough categories, which is gate shows, where you pay on the gate, you turn up, you have fun, you tend to see some celebrities, and it's about, you know, it's about picking up comics, geeking out, and also seeing famous people talk about cool things. You get traditional cons, which are things like EasterCon and Nine Worlds, which is where fans are doing things for fans, and there is some celebrity, but it's more, you know, a traditional con is where you get to go on a panel that compares Supernatural and Lost Girl, and it'll have two fans and maybe a scriptwriter on there. And then that's that sort of thing. And the third is the big nerd freak out, or the big geek freak out, where they have a big disco that, you know, with stormtroopers and Daleks. And that's a combination of the two as a general rule.
And just think, if Claire wasn't actually helping her former school friend celebrate their birthday, she might have been there as well.
I'm kind of gutted. It's so close to home. It's Yorkshire. Heartbroken.
Well, there you go. It's during the day, of course, so, you know, combine both.
I could get trained.
Well,
yeah.
You know, there is a way.
There's a bubble of chance there.
There is always a way. and Fiona, will you be back up in Edinburgh? You haven't even been to Scarborough yet, have you?
No, I don't think I have.
Well, there we are. It's a whole new world for your good self. Mary?
No, I'm not going to make it to Scarborough, unfortunately.
There we are. Let's talk Tim Martin. Let's talk X-Files. I don't know if you've seen the series, which is now into its almost season finale as far as British TV viewers are actually concerned. Heavily criticised, and you wouldn't have seen this particular article, Ed, but I'll run it past you just for the sort of lines. The X-Files Episode 5, Babylon, it's time to sack Chris Carter and three other things we learned. Yes. Very vitriolic piece. I've sent this to our Los Angeles correspondent, Phil Leonis, because obviously Phil co-hosts Chilpack Hollywood with Dean Haglund, one of the lone gunmen who does make an appearance in Babylon. And we get the whole notion of Tim Martin saying, what I'm about to say is the sort of thing that gets you monstered in X-Files circles, but the solution to the ongoing woes of this season is simple. Ditch showrunner Chris Carter. Yes, he invented and devised the show and was chief cheerleader for its revival. Yes, he implemented the format, mythology, archers, interspersed with one-off spooky investigations. But then it got squashed by a gigantic Monty Python foot of The Wire, House of Cards and streaming TV. I'll just conclude the sort of line before you have a chance to respond to this, Ed. I mean, it's almost as incendiary as the Doctor Who debate became in Starburst recently. But now Carter is down to this pure WTF. What the flip? Slicing some circa 2001 Islamo-bomo-phobia with a wincingly cute plot line in which Mulder and Scully meet agents who could be young younger versions of themselves. One of them is called Miller and is a profiler obsessed with the paranormal, and one's a doctor called Einstein with coppery hair who pities that poor agent Scully. He's not happy. And I don't know, have you picked up that sort of line?
I have seen that episode, yes. And I pick up his vibe. I see where he's coming from, but as an episode that goes on the back of, because obviously with X-Files, you kind of get this balance of monster episodes, silly episodes, and mythology episodes. And this is not a mythology episode, this is not a monster episode, it's a decidedly silly episode. I think it falls flat. I think the Islamophobia, he's quite right, there is Islamophobia there. It's hackneyed, but it's hackneyed from our perspective as Europeans. The idea of Mulder on a journey of self-discovery, I think, is wasted, but if you forgive the pun. But it does have some fun moments, and it does have some highlight moments. I'm intrigued as to what they're going to do with Einstein and Miller, because obviously, you know, that we're going to think, oh, that's a set for the Next Generation, and it's X-Files, so it's probably not going to be that at all. It's probably going to be a twisty, turny thing. It's a silly, fun episode. Relax and laugh at it. If that's the only season clunker, if that's what you think is the only season clunker, then great, to be honest. You know, if that's as bad as it gets, then we're doing fine.
Well, as we've heard, Phil Linus already said it was the first one that really was the weak one from his perspective. But as indeed the writer says, if mushrooms allowed you to talk to dead terrorists, Glastonbury would be the most terrifying place on Earth. Well, actually, it probably is. Anybody see the X-Files? No, that's okay. Does anybody? You see, they're all born probably after or just on the time when the X-Files actually launched. But they're in for a treat when they actually see the full six episodes in full force. And apparently it ends on a cliffhanger. So there you are. Claire, any questions you want to put to Ed Fortune?
I guess, what has this last week had in store for you? Anything exciting?
What has this last week had in store for you? The tenses that have been mixed up from that point.
An English student. I write
tense,
the words.
Exactly. it's like reading a Stephen Moffat script, honestly, sometimes.
Start sentences with a proposition.
Exactly.
Right, so that's your job. This week, we've been putting the magazine to bed, pretty much. It's a Civil War special. So there's lots and lots of goodies, but pretty much I've been obsessed with trying to get as many different things into the magazine as possible. And we tend to pack it. There's always stuff that we don't get a chance. So I think we're putting online. I had a chat with the Blaine brothers, who do some absolutely fantastic, weird little indie films. And we just didn't really have the space. So I think we're probably going to put that online. And if you can, you should check it out on the Stubbis Magazine website. And if not, if we do end up getting it into another issue, then you should read it there instead. But the issue that's coming out is Captain America. So we talk about the Civil War episode. We talk about Captain Britain, because why not? We also talk about all the other Marvel crossover events. Does anyone remember the Diary of War, or is it just me? We'll get to talk about Secret Wars, that sort of thing. So we've got a whole bunch of stuff. So that's pretty much been my you know, world.
And those dire wraiths, presumably up against Rom, as opposed to exactly. Well, long before Stargate Atlantis got a hold of them, these were dire wraiths.
Anyway. This is why we'll never see it, though, because the rights have gone back to Hasbro. And now IDW have the rights to Rom the Space Knight. So we'll never see Captain America, Iron Man, Power Fist, Power Man and Iron Fist, and Spider Man fight shape shifting aliens.
And the world in our dimension will be just a little less sort of rich as a result of that. But nevertheless, you know, apart from when we talk shape shifting aliens, we can only mean Mary Dancy. Mary, sorry, it's the same as you. Would you like to put those last two questions to Ed Fortune, please?
Yes, Ed, have you had an interesting telephonic link with us today?
Of course, I always do.
Good, good, good. And will you be joining us again soon?
Absolutely.
Yay! Cue the tap dancing.
We are heading out to sea, and however it'll be, it ain't gonna be the same. 'Cause no matter what we see when we're out there on the sea, we ain't gonna see a dame. Thank you.
And while the dance routine continues in the background, Emily, I think you've got a Penny Evans' epic response to the X-Files to share with the listener.
Yep, so she said, "I'm a big fan, but I feel X-Files is not as good with the writing style as it used to be, but what TV show is today? Glenn Morgan's Home Again was the best so far, and not just because I was there watching it being filmed. What I love was Carter's morale, that extreme hate and extreme love should find some middle ground. Really do not like the new agents, like mini-me's. Don't agree sacking Chris Carter, though, and I do think that from fans' point of view, it was because of the Muslim terrorist story. I thought he was very brave to tackle something like that, and it's a touchy subject. Sadly, some fans thought he was being Islamophobic, but I clearly disagree. He definitely looked at both sides of the coin. I agree with Phil Leonis that the first one was the worst. For me, it was previously on The X-Files for over half an hour. I have to say my favourite character has to be Scully these days."
Here's how it will be. I'm gonna dance with you, pal. You're gonna dance with me. When we're out there on the sea, we'll be happy as can be. Or so the captain plays.
But we have to disagree, cause the only guarantee is I'll see a lot of you and you'll see a lot of me.
And it's absolutely certain that we'll see a lot of sea.
Interesting to see what Richard Fitzwilliams makes of Hail Caesar, but for me it actually needed Emily's read-through right in the middle of the tap dancing routine, personally. I wonder what Phil Leonis makes of all that. Phil, welcome to the programme!
Hail Caesar's unbelievably brilliant and so deceptively meaningful and deep, which I think is one of the reasons why it's not getting the acclaim of other Coen Brothers films. But here's a movie about how deceptively intellectuals were able to get powerful, world-changing messages into movies, and here's a movie that has the exact same thing, and of course people are too blind and to be able to see it. So it's a fantastic movie that embodies everything that it's expressing, and it brings us to the X-Files episode Babylon. I love that. Of course, X-Files fans would call for Chris Carter's head without understanding that the episode they'd just seen was making fun of all of them. It's an episode about binary belief systems, either blind belief, blind acceptance, or blind skepticism. And Chris Carter has been around the fandom long enough now to realize that at either turn, that's pretty much what he gets. He either gets people where everything that has the X-Files name on it is going to be good, including that awful first episode. There are people who actually think the first episode was good, even though it was borderline incompetent. And then on the other hand, you have those fans who are going to absolutely criticize everything. So there really is no middle ground. There really is no winning when it comes to the fandom. And this episode was about the episode in question, Babylon, was about the fandom. And that's why the mirror of these agents as younger, to try to remind them of the polemics that were at stake. So it's a very clever episode that's got a lot more going on than people are giving it credit for. But again, who could expect more from the people?
Here. In 168 hours or so from now, you will hear a phrase on the Midweek Drive which includes the words Star Trek guru, Nemechek, and carcass. I just sort of raised that. That's no more clues, but there we are. Carcass, Star Trek guru, Nemechek. In 168 hours from now. But, Phil, we're remiss because the team, obviously, a quintet of quality. Tessa Snow, Emma... Oh, no, not Emma. She's not with us. She hasn't left us completely. She's chilling out. Claire Margerison, Emily Jones, Mary Dancy, and Fiona Williams. Where did you start off with the show? Was it the Los Angeles Master Chorale? Was it earlier? What sort of words of wisdom can you bring to us?
The Master Chorale, of course.
Of course.
That's where I always begin the show, whether they are represented or not.
Exactly. There you go. So where do you wish to take the team?
Oh, I liked your comment about, the need to learn about other places. And your little aside, you promised you wouldn't get political, but your little aside. some of our people running for major office in this country seeming like they could stand to learn a little bit about other people in other places. And it reminds me of a theme that we expressed not that long ago on your Chilpak Hollywood Hour, our weekly show, that fundamentally people don't want to feel stupid. People will go to almost any lengths to avoid feeling stupid, even going to the length of not learning in the first place, because they feel like trying to learn something will be an acknowledgement of what they don't know, and they will feel stupid. And I think we see a lot of that in our political discourse. People will be called on incorrect statements that they've made, and they will entrench even deeper into their incorrect statement because they don't want to acknowledge that they were mistaken, because they might come off looking stupid.
Okay, let's hold it there, Phil.
Nonstop effort. Yeah.
Let's do our straw poll. Claire Margerison, do you take that line? Do you sort of sometimes avoid saying anything or commenting because you don't want to look stupid?
Yeah, I kind of had this situation a bit with Facebook yesterday, because I got into a discussion with someone about feminism and International Women's Day, and someone decided to post a picture about male privilege and how certain things that happen to men don't happen to women, and therefore there isn't a need for feminism, or something along those lines. And I got into a discussion with him, and he basically... I'm quite a stubborn person when it comes to my opinions, but I don't think... And I will admit when I'm wrong, but it was... I think there tends to be a habit of people being scared to talk about these things for fear of ridicule. Like, he was very, very aggressive and very demeaning and very ridiculing towards me, and therefore I do not normally get into that sort of discussion, because it always ends up in someone...
You hit them, basically.
Claire. Yeah, you just want to, don't you?
Yeah. And you know, that's brilliant, because what you have to realize when you're in that position, because we all find ourselves in that position, and what you have to realize often is the very thing you're feeling, that reluctance to go into it because you don't want to be made to feel stupid, is probably what's motivating that person's aggressiveness in the first place. They're going on the offense so that they don't have to reveal where their knowledge lacks, right? They're worried that if they close their mouth, their brain might start to work.
How true those words are. Let's talk to Fiona. Fiona, who's actually been doing the entire show with a severe scraped arm injury. How did you do that, Fiona?
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I just tripped. I tripped outside. And it's very
it's
sore.
It's not good. It needs a plaster. And whereabouts specifically? Was it paving stone? Can we sue the council? Sorry, I'm getting a sort of Chilpak Hollywood lawsuit of the week thing here.
I can't really remember.
Come on. Anyway, same question to your good self. Do you ever sort of back down because you think, I just don't want to give that sort of sense?
Yes and no, because I think people are too quick to jump on you and just sort of have a go if you're not politically correct or if you say something that isn't right. I think a lot of shows also have that problem. It's a difficult balance between...
Like talking very slowly for people in Louisiana, as we found. Talking very slowly for people in Louisiana.
Yeah.
There's a Cameron Tilbury line. I still think he was wrong. Never mind.
Definitely.
You know, Phil didn't even realise Jack Harrison was back on the show.
Shocking.
I know. Exactly. And he's left now. Mary...
When was that? When was Jack
this
back?
This very day. It was Indie Girls. See, we didn't ladies. Jack Harrison, you can see the Facebook photographs. You'll be able to actually hear it as well, if we can ever actually rescue it from the computer. Anyway,
carry on. Yeah, no, I completely agree with Fiona. I think that sometimes it does deter people just to openly discuss, like, touchy topics and whatnot. But, yeah, I guess with what we've been saying, that actually, you know, you need to keep going and keep discussing, because that's how we're all going to improve at the end of the day. But
so there seems to me to be two responses that we're hearing in this, to this fear that we all have to not feel stupid. Some people will just remain silent, which is terrifying, because you know, everybody has wisdom, whether they realize they have their own wisdom or not. Everyone has wisdom, and we'd all be well suited to hear hear it. So we want more people to speak, and also we want people asking questions, because the better questions that get asked, the more we'll all learn. But the other impulse is not just to remain silent. The other impulse, when we're scared of feeling stupid, is to go on the attack about something, to try to ridicule it before it can make us feel stupid. And this is what we were talking about on our show, that the hatred and animosity that was being directed by people in the business towards the new film from Terrence Malick, not a movie that I think works. And yet I found myself wanting to defend this movie from all the hatred being directed from people who did not understand it.
It's like Star Trek the Motion Picture all over again. Emily, who thoughts?
Oh, my goodness. Thanks for ruining a meaningful conversation with Star Trek. I see what you were doing. You were embodying an example of what I'm describing.
That's
people
so
will
good.
Often just change the subject to avoid
squirrel.
Of discomfort.
Right. Emily, back with the discussion.
Star Trek, the motionless picture? Really? That was what? Because that one was so hard to understand. B-E-E-R. V-G... Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Sorry.
I don't want to now. No. Yeah, what I was going to say was I try not to sort of get in an argument with somebody if I don't know all the facts. So, like, I will argue something till I'm blue in the face if I feel like I know a lot about it. Whereas if it's something that I don't know lots about, I try to sort of not get into arguments about it until I can sort of know more. But I'm the kind of person that I'm always asking questions, like, no matter what I'm doing, like, when I'm at work or whatever, I'm never not asking questions. And when I meet new people, I always, you know, say I meet somebody with a different religion to me, I'm always asking, tell me more about your beliefs, you know, why do you believe those things? And sometimes people don't like it, but most of my friends I'm close with because I ask those kind of questions, because I'm really interested to know.
Learning is fun, and the truth is that I witnessed this when I was following Dean around making our documentary, The Truth Is Out There. If you ask people questions and you do so for a long enough conversation where they realize that you're not judging the answers they give you, you literally just want to learn how they think and learn about them, it's amazing how much defensiveness will just ease away and conversation will be invited. Like, I actually, the longer I live, the more I do see the wisdom in Oscar Wilde's line, any issue worth debating is worth avoiding altogether. You stay out of arguments. Good for you. I don't see why there actually have to be very many arguments. I always believe a conversation can be elevated out of the argument stage, and it usually can be elevated by asking better questions.
Tessa.
I'm the same as Emily. I like to ask a lot of questions, and I remember somebody telling me that no question is a silly question. So.
She's like a female Socrates at times.
But I think it's a confidence thing as well with people, but questions are how you learn. So.
This simple
I did
feeling.
I did have a cinema professor, the most brilliant professor I've ever had. I learned more in his class than, you know, much like he was my Alex Lefchuk. And he once said in a lecture, he said, you know, there really are, it's true, there really are no stupid questions. There are stupid people asking them, however.
This simple feeling is beyond Vigia's comprehension. I rest my case.
V-G-E-R. V-O-Y-A-G-E-R.
Exactly.
Voyage. Oh, my goodness.
Larry Nemec.
Spoiler alert, everybody.
Exactly. We'll find her. Penny has just said she's not afraid to speak. See post below. I think we'll find that out, Penny. Absolutely. Wraps up a variety of other bits and pieces. Mary, anywhere you'd like to take Phil in the remaining few moments of the production?
Oh, I'm not sure.
No, that's exactly. Fiona?
No.
Emily? Claire?
No, we're tired.
They worked so hard. Yeah. You see, Phil, this is what happens when Jack Harrison does the first hour of the programme. The rest of it, it's like after the Lord Mayor's show to actually routine. You know, Jack's in the studio, he's in the house. It's like, you know, Michael Jackson, Elvis Presley being embodied in one particular thing, wrapped up with Take That and One Direction, he's left, and the rest of us have to just carry on.
I think you do. Right, I've thought of something now. I think you do get stupid questions occasionally, because I genuinely had a friend. We were watching Shaun of the Dead, and she turned around and she actually asked me, would it hurt if I got shot? Which I didn't really know how to answer that. Well, yes.
No, that's a brilliant question, and you answer her with the line, probably not, because where there is no sense, there is no pain.
Yeah, there you go.
Wisdom.
Yeah. Quick, bring in Willie Watson.
You know, any good answer can redeem a bad question.
Lay the old moon, keep shining, shining down for me. Lay the old moon, I'm pining, pining just to be. On that old plantation where I used to roam, light my weary way back home. Lay the old moon, keep shining, shining down for me.
If nothing else, you can't accuse this programme of not being musically diverse. Thank you. Willie Watson there, Lazy Old Moon. That was in place of a track by Paul Weller for you, Phil.
We also can't accuse you of not using double negatives.
I know! I threw it in there deliberately. Sir, nobody does nothing but itself, a piece of the action, you know? Anyway.
You know what? Double negative. Now, after we're done with Culture Shapers, Alex, talking about great science fiction films, we should pick films or topics to debate, and we could call it, just because the name of it, Double Negative, would be awesome.
I think we'll look to that. And in terms of spoiler alerts, I can reveal that Richard Fitzwilliams and myself gave exactly the same score to Hail Caesar. I can't say anything else because it's after midnight when it actually gets transmitted your time, Phil, obviously, tomorrow morning at 8, just after 8 o'clock. Right then.
Hey, we're changing clocks here next week. Is that happening there?
Do you know, that's very significant. It will be happening here, but is it this? I don't think it's this weekend, so we may well be moving soon. Slightly ahead. We'll have to coordinate ourselves here. Especially
there's going to be math involved. Oh, my goodness.
And we've got so many sort of Los Angeles links.
I'm American. We don't do math. So.
Well, you know, we've got Arthur Weingarten, we've got the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, we've got the question about how does a deaf musician compose, Margaret Batcher, and Larry Nemechek, who indeed once wrote an episode of Voyager featuring Garrett Wang, who I believe you actually have worked with, Phil, or am I incorrect in that assumption?
You are incorrect. Okay. I mean, if you mean tip out of drinks at a party at Dragon Con,
oh, well,
then
there we are.
We have worked together.
Exactly. I was using it as a euphemism for obviously alcoholic inebriation, or indeed.
Oh, you just assumed that it was an adult libation. It might have been
exactly.
It might have been punch.
Precisely. No. So, which has brought us neatly round to the last two questions. So, I don't even chance to actually slot in Mike Dooley's notes for the universe. Oh, I don't know. Tessa, give me a number, please, between 2 and 26.
21.
Mm-hmm. You sure you've never gone for 21 before?
Oh, I may have. Shall I change?
No. 21 okay. is what you've gone okay. for. You just about squeeze it in.
To set the record straight, however cool you think it might be to have an out-of-body experience, floating over your house, flying through space, traversing the past, present, and future, let me tell you, it'll never be as cool as being in the one you now have. Walking barefoot in the grass, floating on the sun-drenched pool, or dancing alone in the dark.
Excellent. Okay, so moving on. Oh, thank you. Blinky about to take us out of the programme, but not before. Claire Margerison has thrust those last two questions across the transatlantic sphere now.
Have you enjoyed your telephonic link with us today, Phil?
I have enjoyed my telephonic
link. Is this all that there is? Is there nothing more?
And will you join us again soon?
I will indeed. V-G-E-R.
What do you think we should do? Spank it? Thanks to Claire Margerison, Emily Jones, Fiona Williams, Mary Dancy, and Tessa Snart, Cameron Tilbury, Anna Lewis, Jean Davidson, Jack Harrison, Ed Fortune, and Phil Dinas. Thank you, dear listener. And, of course, thanks to Penny Evans, because she contributes to the show in her own magical way. That's it. We're out of here. Can we say bye-bye?
Bye.
Bye-bye.